My name is Pastor Tufu. I'm giving the message today. We're continuing on in our series, Follow Me. And I want to give you guys a little background about how this sermon series came about and also some of the things that we kind of want to accomplish. This is actually our last part of the series, Follow Me. And one thing I realize is that a lot of us grow up, at least in Texas, in Christian families or at least Christian communities. So can I get a show of hands? How many of you guys went to church as a kid or knew a lot of Christians? Right? Like, okay, take a look around. It's pretty much everybody, right? And when we think about following after Christ, I think what happens is we kind of have this this picture of what that's supposed to look like because our parents are Christians, because our friends are Christians, because we have gone to church, right? But I think if we were to take that and superimpose that over what Christ has intended for us in following him, I think we would find a very, very different picture, right? And today I'll be talking about washing one another's feet, and we'll be reading from John 13:1-17. But before we do, let me just review for us some of the messages that you guys have heard, and it's been in line with a Christian is, right? A Christian is. And so if you guys will follow along with me, a Christian is, the first part was, someone who responds to the call of Christ to follow after him. And in that, Pastor Ben spoke about the myth that if you say this prayer, right, then you are automatically a Christian. And he really spoke about how Christianity was not about a singular decision, but about multiple decisions to continually follow after Christ. As well, we talked about a Christian is someone who abides in Jesus and bears fruit. Right, not necessarily just fruit in ministry, right, but also fruits of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness. Right, and last week we talked about a Christian is someone who discovers new life in Christ through death to self. And I was particularly challenged because I thought about all of the examples of Christians who had sacrificed. Not just the martyrs, right, like Jim Elliot that Pastor Ben talked about, but the people within our very communities who give up profession, who give up their finances, who give up their time in order to follow after Christ. And this week we'll be talking about washing one another's feet. The one thing that I would like you all to leave with this with is a Christian is someone who knows God's love and gives God's love. A Christian is someone who knows God's love and gives God's love. And I would like to actually talk about a dysfunction within the Christian world right now, within all of us, that I have seen played out in my own life, in the lives of members, in the lives of leaders, and everyone. And what I've seen is that it robs from us this... the joy in following Christ. It takes from us the very purpose, and it converts all of the good things that we do into this dead religion, right? As Pastor Ben was sharing, even as he was kind of reflecting about what's going on right now in the audience, he was sharing that you all are just going through these routines, right? And this thing has the potential and the ability to change our very hearts, our very intention to something that is not godly, very self-centered. And that thing is that we just do, right? It is following the example. It is just kind of going through the motions, right, of Christianity. I think this is particularly difficult for me to talk about because I've seen, and I'm sure you have as well, people within the church who I love and who have grown up with me just kind of walk away from the faith, right? And they'll say things like, I just did not feel God, or I just don't know if God is still there. And I think if some of us reflect, this is not all of us, but if some of us reflect, that's the fear within our hearts that perhaps God is not there. And I'm wondering if it is because of this dysfunction, the way our perspective and how we see the Christian world and how we see God, that is actually robbing us of these things. So with that, let me read for us John 13:1-17. And let me give you guys a little context as why you, as you all are turning to John 13:1-17. Jesus is actually preparing for the cross. as he's gathered the disciples together and he will wash their feet, right? They are gathered together. They're probably very exhausted. And a very common common thing that would happen during this time is that when they went into a house, the owner of the house would provide for them a handmaid or a slave, usually the lowest of all the slaves. And that slave would wash the feet of the guests, especially the most honored guests, right? And Jesus, as he's about to be crucified, he realizes that no handmaid has been provided, no slave has been provided to wash their feet. And so what he does is he serves them, right? And I think a lot of us have heard this story. Let me just read for us, and we'll kind of find what God has in store for us today. So listen along as I read. This is the ESV version. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of the world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. It's really important for us to note here that when he says love them to the end, he's not talking about his crucifixion. He's actually talking about an enduring love that is eternal, right? And that's the degree in which he's talking about this love. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose up from supper, right? So a couple things here. I want us to notice that he will wash the feet of Judas, his very betrayer, right? Not only that, but he interrupts the normal pattern that they're expecting. You know, they're going to eat. They've already sat down. He disrupts that in order to do something very unusual. That will leave a powerful impression on the disciples, right? He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them and the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but afterwards you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." And Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash your feet, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Right? So you see, Peter here is a little confused, right? He doesn't really understand what God is doing. And I imagine that for a lot of us, as we're going through our Christian life and we're being told to do all these things, right, we don't really understand what God intends for us. But I believe as for Peter, how Jesus will reveal those things, Jesus will reveal those things to us if we search and knock and ask. Where am I? Is it verse 10? Jesus said to him, "The one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you. For he knew who was to betray him, and that was why he said, 'Not all of you are clean.'" So he's talking specifically about Judas here. And let me just park it here. We're actually going to spend a little bit of time talking about Simon Peter. And there are two points that I'm going to elaborate on. The first point is that following Jesus requires humility, and that's what I'm going to talk about now. The next point is following Jesus requires obedience. But let's start here at Simon Peter, okay? There's a little bit more background that you have to know here. The disciples have been following Jesus, and they've seen all of these really crazy miracles. They notice how he attracts all these crowds, and they're a little awed at him because he's just kind of like a walking miracle or a walking miracle maker, right? And they begin to think to themselves, this kingdom that he's building is going to be pretty crazy, right? It's going to be a pretty amazing party. And we all want front row seats, right? And so they begin to actually jockey for position, right? And this happens in the church, even our church, right? You guys all want you're clamoring for the leader's attention, right? You're wanting to be known as that one, right? And it's just kind of human nature. It happens in all organizations, right? Businesses, everything. And even within our own hearts, we see that. We find that there is this kind of this self-centeredness, this wanting of something, whether it's attention or something, right? There are a couple of verses that point to this, right? Not necessarily in John, but in the other Gospels. For example, in Mark chapter 9, you don't have to go here, but let me explain and expound. The disciples are walking, chapter 9, they're walking around, and they start arguing. And Jesus notices this, and he goes, what's going on? Right? They finally arrive in Capernaum, and Jesus sits them down and says, what's going on? Why are you guys arguing? And they all kind of reveal, they kind of give it away. Well, we're arguing to see who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom that you're ushering in, right? That and this is kind of disgusting him. He's like, no. You got it all wrong. It's not about the first, but the last, right? Because the last will be first. And I imagine as they're listening to this, they're like, oh, this is kind of weird. I don't know what you're talking about. First will be last will be first. We'll just kind of, you know, shelve that away and pretend like we don't really, you know, we're not going to ask any questions. Okay, sure, Jesus, right? This happens again. Matthew chapter 20, verse 20. Right, you don't have to go there. I'll tell you guys what happened. The mother of the sons of Zebedee, right? She comes to Jesus in this very like humble, gentle way. She bows down before him and she says, "Hey, Jesus, give me this one thing that I will ask you." Right, and Jesus is like, "What is it that you would like?" And she goes, "Okay, allow my sons to be on your right and your left hand." Right. Give them these positions. Again, we see this kind of jockeying for position and this almost this pride, like they don't understand what it means. And Jesus says, no. Those positions have been reserved, right? And I can't just give those away, right? And so the underlying argument that I'm trying to build here is that there is a sense of pride, right? As Simon is arguing with Jesus, right, there's a sense of a pride. He believes that that he knows better, that there is something more deserving, right, about him, right? And as you look at this, it doesn't look like that. It actually does not look like that at all. Jesus is about to do something that will be demeaning to himself. He's about to be to get down in the dirt and get dirty, right, and wash people's feet like a slave. And Simon is stopping him and saying, no, that's not called for. Don't do that. That's going to be embarrassing, right? And you're not supposed to do that. You are the Lord, right? You are in charge, right? You are our teacher. But what is not seen is that he does not believe Jesus knows what he's doing, right? In this moment, he's like, no, Jesus, you got it all wrong. And I imagine that a lot of us are like that. As God is working in our life and telling us, hey, let me forgive you of these things. Let me work in your life this way. We kind of stand back like, no, Jesus, you don't understand, right? That's actually, you're not allowed to go in that area of my life because that's really, I don't want to mix you and this, right? I don't want to mix you with this this struggle I have. I don't want to mix you with my personal sin. I don't want to mix you with my family. I don't want to mix you with these friends of mine, right? Because it's just not going to work out. Like, you're, like, holy, and they're, you know, they use profanity, they, you know, whatever, right? We kind of have our own excuses. But in a sense, that is all pride. That's all pride. I have a very quick quote for us. This is from Tim Keller in his book, Counterfeit Gods. And let me read this for us. It should be up on the screen as well. The default mode of the human heart is to seek control, to control God and others through our moral performance. Because we have lived virtuous lives, we feel that God and the people we meet owe us respect and support. Though we may give lip service to Jesus as our example and inspiration, we are still looking to ourselves and our own moral striving for salvation. And what Tim Keller is talking about here is this Christian culture that we believe it's about what we do. It's about how long I pray. It's about the nice things I do, right? And that's not what Jesus intends, especially in this situation. The moral of this story of Jesus washing people's feet is not, okay, I wash your feet, now you go do nice things as well, right? That's not what he's getting at here, right? It's much, much deeper and much more complex, right? At the very end of this sermon, I will be asking you to do those things, to care and serve others. But there are actually many, many miles between where we're starting and where that is, that destination. There's a lot to navigate. And I would ask that you kind of pay attention and listen along. Because In the same way that Jesus does not just let Simon Peter off the hook for this kind of outburst, this pride, I don't know if I want to let you off the hook either. Because what, as Pastor Ben and myself and the leaders have been reflecting about where our church is, there's so many good things happening, and there's so many pats that are happening on the back, right? We're just kind of like, yay, this is awesome. But what we notice is that you all are forgetting something very, very crucial, right, to your walk, right? And it has become a very, you know, lockstep. Okay, I go to membership, I go to ministry, I go to missions, right? I go to life group, I go to Access, I go to Sunday, right? And there's this work within your heart that is not happening, right? And it requires some navigation, and it requires some attention. And I hope that as we look at these things, that God will begin to illuminate for you the heart condition that we are all bound to and we all must wrestle with, right? I have 4 points about pride, and we'll go through each of these. But my first point is that pride is the original sin. Pride is the original sin, okay? Now, Peter doesn't realize it, right? We've read this together, Peter doesn't realize that the very root of this sin is pride, right? And actually, it's so subtle that maybe after you read it, you didn't realize it was pride, right? But this is pride. Right, and not only this, but the original sin that entrapped man was pride. Right, so in Genesis, this is how the original sin plays out. The serpent comes to Adam and Eve, and he entices them. Eat this fruit, and you will have knowledge. Right, like God is trying to prevent you from this. I am going to offer you something. I'm going to free you. Right, if you eat this fruit. Right, the serpent does not come and say, "Go and murder." Right, I think Adam and Eve have enough sense about them not to go and murder, right? The serpent doesn't come to Adam and say, hey, why don't you go steal, right? Go steal from Eve, right? He doesn't say, go and lust after this thing, right? He's not saying those things. What he's saying is, hey, God is deceiving you, and I will free you. You have potential beyond what God is allowing you, right? There is something that God is keeping from you, and you know better. You know better, right? It is that pride. It's insidious, and it's kind of worked its way, and that is the thing that initiates the original sin, right? Pride as well is a sin that blinds us to our greatest need, right? If you think about the habits, the Christian habits, not necessarily the good ones, but the Christian habits that entrap us, the things, not even Christian habits, even the habits itself that prevent us from God. It's to say, you know, I can do this. You know, I got this. You know, I got this, Jesus. I know I'm supposed to, you know, like go to you and ask for forgiveness. But guess what? I'm just gonna keep working at this, you know, until I master that sin that I'm struggling with, right? And it is that very pride that prevents us from going to God. As I've been meeting with a lot of you, I think that's what is happening. I don't know if that's how intensely it happens. I think a lot of you feel a little bit ashamed. Like, I don't know if I can approach my LCG. I don't know if I can approach God with this. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to privately, you know, work on it, and hopefully I'll master it, and hopefully there will be a new chance for me to kind of renew and restore this relationship with God. But that actually is pride. That is to say, you know better than God, right? And there are some very deep things that some of you are not responsible for, right? But are now in your life. There are things which have been done to you, right? Friends have hurt you, right? Family members have hurt you, right? The people that you value the most have hurt you. And now you're stuck with all that garbage, and you have nothing, no way to get rid of it, right? And I'm talking to you, as I'm talking to you, and you're sharing, I feel completely helpless because there is nothing you can do, and yet you are working feverishly to conquer this thing, right? It's like you're trapped into this. There's an addiction there. There's something that is overwhelming, and you will not bring it to God because you need to master it, right? There's a poet. I believe his name is W.E. Heasley. Right? He wrote Invictus, right? It's a really powerful poem. They recited in the movie Invictus with Matt Damon, right? And he goes, out of the night, that covers me black as a pit from pole to pole. I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. And it starts out like, oh man, this guy's religious, but actually it's not. What he says is he goes and says, like, though my head is bloody, it is unbowed, right? He talks about this unconquerable soul that even God cannot capture him, right? No suffering can entrap him. And the great tragedy of Heasley, W.E. Heasley, is that his five-year-old daughter dies, right? And this is real. He's a guy, I mean, pretty tragic guy. He's one of his legs is amputated, right, while he's young, and he becomes this poet, and he talks about how he has had to overcome many great obstacles in order to be who he is, right? And he writes this poem out of this huge struggle, and he says, you know, I am indomitable, right? And then tragedy strikes, right? He loses his five-year-old daughter, and there is absolutely nothing he can do to regain her, right? And that's really the tragedy of pride, right? We believe ourselves to be unbreakable, and that is a lie, right? We believe ourselves to be the most intelligent being, right? And so we try to control, right, every little detail, and we cannot because we are not the most intelligent being. Right, we believe ourselves to be the most charming, right? And so we try to work our way out. We try to finesse, but we cannot, right? And we are blind to the solution. And the solution seems so easy, right? Come to God and he will provide, but we don't, right? Pride enslaves us. This is the third point. It enslaves us, right? Because like a gambler who is addicted, right, to those few times in which they have seen wins, right, they continue to come back, right? This is the truth. If you are to live without God, you will see good days, right? You will see success, right? But that's not the only truth, right? And I think, like the addict that continues to return to a drug, right? That person who is so obsessed with relationships, they continue to return to these broken relationships, hoping to get love. We are enslaved to ourselves because there are victories, but those victories, they're really temporary, right? They don't actually last. They don't sustain us in a real eternal way, right? Think about the heroin addict, right? Constantly scratching and trying to get enough to provide a small bit of alleviation, right? A little bit of joy. But what happens, right? There's a crash at the end of that high, right? And the same goes for us, right? And the thing is, we are entrapped not by ourselves, but our very culture. Right now, in life groups, we're going through the book Radical. And the book Radical is actually written specifically for Americans, right? Because Americans, well, we have accepted this thing, this very beautiful idea called the American dream, right? And that is that you are able to pull yourself up from your bootstraps. If you work hard enough, you will earn and receive whatever it is that you desire, right? And that is a very beautiful idea. But what is entrapping about it is that we make it the ultimate thing, right? We believe that that is all we require is hard work, ambition, right, and determination, right? But when you think about it, the things that enable a person to become successful, right, are, yes, their ambition. They need those things, right? They need that thing, right? It is their hard work, yes, but there are much more, right? It is the family that you were born into, right? It is the era, the very time in which you were born. Imagine if you were born in the 1300s, these things would not be possible for you, right? It doesn't matter how hard you worked at your field, you would not become a millionaire, right? You just wouldn't happen. It is also the very genetic makeup, right? We can't change it, guys. When I was in high school, I dreamed of becoming an NFL football player, right? There's nothing. I was a linebacker in football, but there's absolutely no way I could do that. I'm 5'8" almost, right? And 100 and maybe 70 pounds, right? I am not a 6'3", 250-pound linebacker, right? There are just genetic things that prevent us from becoming who we are. But we are enslaved to this idea that if we work hard enough, right, we can accomplish it. Right, there's I think his name is Zig Ziglar. He's like a motivational speaker. He says, the reason why we some of us struggle is because we have the wrong perspective. Like we judge a fish by its ability to climb trees or something like that. Something goes something like that, right? So we think, okay, this is what you're supposed to do. This fish is supposed to climb trees, and it can't climb a tree. And so we're like, oh, you have failed, fish, right? we have that same perspective about our own lives, right? We're like, oh, you know what? I'm supposed to be a certain way. I'm supposed to be, you know, I don't know. We believe so much that if we just work hard enough that we can become those things. And yes, there is some truth to that. If you do not work hard, chances are you will not achieve those things that you're wanting. But the reverse is, there's another side to that, that there are factors which are not within your control, right? And it is that when we think about those things that we are humbled. It is the very opposite of pride. It is in accepting those things that we turn to God, right? And we receive from him, right, grace, right? God says in James 4, right, that he opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble, right? And I think that we as a church and you as individuals are entrapped by pride, right? By this desire to conquer, to be indomitable, right? And you are separated from God's grace in many ways, right? You're separated because you refuse to ask God, right? We have because we ask not. We have not because we ask not. Finally, along with pride, pride leads us to ensnare and enslave others. Pride causes us to enslave others, right? I have been working at the YMCA in North Austin. It's an at-risk community. Most of the parents earn about as much as a college student who has a part-time job. And they're all on public assistance. It's public housing. And the story that they tell me is, the kids tell me is, you know, they want all these things, right? And the parents will say this, right? They're working really hard, right? And I look at their lives and they actually work really hard, right? A lot of them have jobs, but they just don't make much at it. You know, they work at Taco Bell. You know, they work at like these different factories and whatnot. But when I think about them, there is a lie that sits over them that says, "You are poor because you did not work hard enough," right? And these parents, a lot of them have two jobs. I'm there babysitting them pretty much. I'm after school care because their parents aren't allowed to. They can't be there because they're working. Right, and a lot of these parents are, yeah, they're just working so hard, just trying to get, you know, a step ahead, you know. But the thing that has entrapped them is believe it or not, this cultural concept that they must work harder, right? That it's because of something that you did, right? And we actually buy into it, right? And pride, it is our very pride. Like me sitting here and saying, oh, I have a good job because I worked hard. Like those are the things that have entrapped them and prevent them from seeing that they are not, and so I guess what I'm saying is they have this very low self-esteem because they feel like they have done something wrong, right? And in fact, it is not anything that they have done wrong, but it is the very condition that they are in. And with that, let me move on to the second point, that following Jesus requires obedience. But before I move on, let me say that when I look at the story of Simon Peter, I realize that he is as much entrapped as we are, right? It's not like he's a really bad person, right? It's not like he's like, he's trying to be evil to Jesus, but he does not see, right? And I'm hoping that in the same way that Jesus promises him, one day you will see, right? That Jesus will do the same with us. You know, I think there is a lack of light within our life, right? There's a lack of illumination. And as I said before, pride blinds us. There's a great deal of pride. I pray that as we examine this, God will expose some of your pride, and maybe not now, but maybe soon, that there will be this realization. So let me read on. Let's start at verse 12, John 13, verses 12. And this will lead me to my second point. When he had washed their feet, so Peter agrees to have his feet washed, and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Right, and let me just stop there. If I were a disciple, I'd be like, what? What is this mess, right? Because here's what he did. He just went to the lowest place. He got dirty on the ground and washed my feet. Now he's saying I'm supposed to wash people's feet? And this is, I don't know what I bought into, right? Like, I'm here for the miracles. I'm here for the kingdom. I want my place. I don't want to be, you know, cleaning between people's toes. That's not why I'm here, right? But that's actually what Jesus is saying, right? And let me finish it off. Verse 17, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them, right? So they are at this place. They don't even know yet. They're confused, right? And he's saying, I want you not only to know this, right? But I want you to do it, right? And then be blessed, okay? To do it and be blessed. My second point is that following Jesus requires obedience, right? A lot of us, as we think about following Jesus, we want to know ahead of time, hey, God, what's the secret? Like, why am I doing this? Even our life group members, they'll come to us, hey, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this fast thing? Like, tell me the reason, and if I agree with it, I'll sign on, right? But that's not how God works. There is this perfect quote. We actually read it yesterday in our leadership meeting, and it comes from Robert E. Coleman. He's kind of the guru of discipleship in the last 20 years, 30 years, right? He wrote this book called Master Plan of Evangelism. And in that, he outlines God's plan in disciples, raising disciples. He says, Jesus was not so much concerned about the crowds. He really focused his attention on 12. Robert E. Coleman wrote this thesis as his PhD, and then he converted it into a book. And it's really changed the way that the Christian world understands discipleship. Like, I think for a long time, a lot of Christians believed, you know, you just got to attract the biggest crowd, right? You just got to build the biggest mega church, and then you'll be influential. But Robert E. Coleman kind of flips that all on its head and says, no, it's about being faithful with 12, right? It's about, like, discipleship, the one-on-one interpersonal relationships that get magnified as that happens throughout the different disciplees, right? So this is the quote he writes. The disciples' obedience did not correlate directly with their understanding of Jesus' teachings. In fact, they were far from understanding Jesus as he talked about the cross and servanthood. Supreme obedience was interrupted to be the interpreted to be the expression of love. If the disciples were to love Jesus, it would be shown in their obedience to his words. Right. So pretty much what he's saying is you don't need to know. That's what he's saying. Like, you don't need to know. Like, just do it, right? Which I don't think would fly very well with you all, right? Like, if life group was just like, just do it, just do this. And you'd be like, wait, this is a cult. I'm not coming back, right? Like, this is weird, right? But that's actually what he's saying. Jesus is saying, okay, you don't know. It's really hard for me to explain right now because there's a bunch of things that need to happen first, right? You are miles from being where you need to be, supposed to be, right? But just do it, and I promise you, it'll make sense, right? And so in the same way, Jesus is saying to them, hey, you got to trust me, right? With the whole feet washing thing. And I imagine they're confused, right? And then he says, go wash other people's feet, and they're like even more confused, right? But he's saying, okay, just trust me on this. I don't think he's saying literally, by the way. But he's saying, you know, this is how you're supposed to serve. So first point, obedience is scary. Obedience is scary. I think for me, obedience is scary because it requires faith, right? And when we first came down to Austin in 2008, it required obedience. I had just graduated from college. I didn't have much money. I think I had like $900 in my bank account, right? And and I had to ship my car over, and it cost $800. So I was like, oh my gosh, how am I even going to survive, right? It was really terrifying, right? I was excited for sure, because I was like, man, like a new city, this is Texas, right? I'm really excited, but I was really scared, right? As well, I believe that for some of you guys, as you guys have been trying to step out in faith, right, it's a little bit scary. I'm really comforted, though, by this story in the Bible about Joshua, right? So Joshua, I'll just kind of like give you guys a really quick version, right? So Joshua is sent with Caleb and a bunch of other people into the promised land, and they're like, okay, just go and then come back and report to us, right? And they come back and they're like, oh my gosh, the people are gigantic there. I don't know if we can actually conquer it, right? And then people are terrified. They're so scared that they veto Moses. And even though Joshua's like, I think we can do it, they're like, no. Have you seen them? Right? Vetoed, right? And the thing is, when I think about this, it's like, yes, our fears can actually win out, right? In the end, it's not always God will fix everything. But actually, our fear actually can win out, and we can actually be disobedient and be separated from God's purpose, right? Temporarily, I'll bet, you know, for them it was 40 years, right? But we can be separated, right? And obedience is scary, right? But the flip side is true as well. And the flip side is, my second point, obedience frees us from this self-dependence. Obedience is freeing, okay? Obedience is freeing. As I said before, I think a lot of us are very talented people. I think in order to be here, right, at the University of Texas, even to be among your peers, you actually have to work really hard. And some of you guys are like, oh my gosh, I was like valedictorian. I was salutatorian of my high school, and now I'm like nobody, right? So I know, like, you guys have worked really hard. There are a lot of things you have had to perfect and work on, right? But the real danger is that as we kind of start to buy into that belief that it's all about me, right? It's all about what I can do. We have to control every variable within our life. We have to make sure that we have just the right internship, right? We have to make sure that we have just the right grades, right? We have to make sure that we make just the right connections, right? And as a student, that is incredibly consuming, because you cannot have perfect anything, right? I don't know if you've tried, right? Perfect, you can't do it. It's really, really difficult. As well, for those of us who are working, right, we believe if we just have the right job, right, we will be guaranteed this happiness. If we just have the right coworkers, if we're just in the right department, right, we'll be on a level beyond our peers. We'll have one leg up, right? If we just knew this thing, right, like if we just had this information, things would be so different. But that's not necessarily the case, because there is no perfect, right? But the crazy thing about obedience is that it frees us from this self-dependence, right? It frees us from this anxiety. You know who the most carefree people are in the world? Kids. The kids are so carefree. They'll cry and stuff over, like, you know, small things, right? But they are so carefree because they live a life of pretty much obedience. I don't know. Pretty much, because I work with kids. They don't all obey, right? But pretty much, they just kind of do what you tell them to, and they don't actually worry about all these things, right? And I think it is that childlike heart that God desires in our faith. I don't think he desires, like, this ignorance, this blindness, where we just, you know, kind of become robots. But I do think he desires us to trust, right, and have this dependence on God. And that is freeing in so many ways. As well, obedience opens us to Christ's love, right? Obedience opens us to Christ's love. And this is a very specific way that happens in John 13, right? Simon Peter is fighting Jesus. No, 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 don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, right? But Jesus is saying, okay, no, I have to do this. And the thing that really kind of amazes me is not only Simon Peter, but John, right? This is actually written in the Bible, which means that although they did not understand it in this moment, although as they were going through it, they were confused and unsure and maybe like a little uncomfortable, you know, why are you wiping my toes, right? What happens later on, probably, is they look back, they probably look back at this. Jesus was about to be crucified. He was about to be betrayed by one of his closest friends, right? And what did he do? He served me, right? He became a slave and wiped my feet, washed my feet, right? I imagine, you know, John is a little more emotional one. He's the one that Jesus loved, right? I imagine John, for the rest of his days, right, would think back to this, and he would just, with tears in his eyes, remembering how Jesus had loved him, right? I think that that was the very source that enabled him to suffer and endure, right, so much. Remember, he's the one, the last one, last of the disciples to remain, right? He's sent to the island of Patmos. He's alone, right? And I think for him, he continued to talk about Jesus' love, right, in his letters, right, in his correspondences with other people. And I think he was so captured by not just this act, but the acts of love in which Jesus had performed, right? How unlikely is that, that those that we are supposed to follow end up serving us in this way that is selfless, right? That does not give promotion to them, right? And that's what Jesus does, right? It is obedience. When Peter was obedient, he received this. He could have been the one that didn't receive it. Had he, you think if he fought hard enough, Jesus would have been like, okay, I'll wash everybody else's, but not yours, right? No, I think Jesus was intending, right? I'm going to wash everybody's feet. Judas Iscariot, who will betray me, I'll wash his feet as well, right? That probably forever left a mark within them. And Jesus' result, what he was wanting, the end was not, I want them to be nice, loving people. I don't think that's where we want to park this, right? Because Jesus himself says, I am giving you an example that you should do just as I have done, right? What he's saying is, I am inviting you into this ministry, right? As I am doing to you, right, you should do to others, right? He is saying that you are part of me. Right? He's not just saying, okay, I'm going to be nice to you, now pay it forward. That's not what he's saying here. It's so much deeper. It's saying, you are now part of an extension of my ministry by me doing this to you. And today, actually, we are all extensions of this ministry because someone has done something similar. They have given and loved sacrificially, right? And in the same way, Jesus calls us and he empowers us, right, to serve others. I think it would be, I don't know if this is going to happen, right? But it would be a huge tragedy if this was the final generation of our church. And I think that this happens. You're like, oh, that's silly. You know, that wouldn't happen. It happens, right? There are churches, right, where I was just talking to a brother earlier, and they're just saying, hey, you know what? We're really afraid because all of our parents are getting older, right? And all of my peers, right, or majority of my peers, they don't believe like mom and dad believed, right? They don't go to church and pray like mom and dad prayed, right? I think there's a real danger with maybe not that this would happen across the board, but that this would happen, that we are served and loved, that someone washes our feet, someone sacrifices to us, and we walk away with this sense of entitlement. Oh, they should have. You know, that's what they're supposed to do, right? I'm supposed to be taken care of, right? And I think of all the generations, we're probably the most susceptible to this. I sincerely hope that what happens instead is that as we are served, you know, as our life group leaders love us, right, and hold the door open for us, feed us, care for us, that we in turn, out of that an extension of God's love, are able to do that to someone else, right? We have been fighting this consumer culture, consumer Christian culture, since day one, right? And I think at some moments it actually wins out, right? We actually lose out, and this consumer mentality ends up winning out. And it happens in the most subtle ways. It's like, oh, I love Life Group because of the community, because of what they give me. What they're saying is because of what they give me. I love Life Group because they grow me, right? Which is a really good thing. That's what we intend to do. But what is at the very heart of it sometimes is it's because of me, right? I'm wanting something, and they fill this need, right? And I think the danger in that is that we forget, as Pastor Ben was sharing, that we cannot have 20% serving, right? We cannot be just a bureaucracy, right, where we get our fix and we leave, right? That there has to be this Christ-like love that is sacrificial, that is embodied within each of us. And The funny, yeah, the thing is, Jesus does not make this like a sacrament. He's not making this like, this is now a, you know, part of your Christian tradition, feet washing, right? But this is much more personal. This is saying, you go love that person in a way where you can get nothing out of it, right? You go and love that person how I am loving you, right? I don't know what that is, looks like, or what that is supposed to be for the people that we meet. But I know that if we were to love people with this sacrificial, selfless love, we would see so many people come to know Christ, right? I tell people on missions all the time as I'm training them, right? Sometimes a peanut butter sandwich communicates God's love so much more powerfully than the gospel story, right? It's because, like, sometimes we fast, right, and we're really hungry, and the kids will come, and they're like, they want food to eat because they haven't eaten all day either. And when people give away their peanut butter sandwich, right, people are like, oh, my gosh, you gave me this, right? Oh, I feel so loved. Maybe the illustration is more powerful for me because I'm always hungry. But, yeah, a peanut butter sandwich sometimes communicates God's love more than the whole gospel, like articulating the gospel, right? And we have to be those agents that give our sandwiches away, okay? The life application for us is that we are to love others as Christ has loved them. I started off the message saying that there was this problem within our church that we will just do, right? We will just do. And I end with this, that you are to do, right? But the difference is that having been loved, right, the very motivation in which we do those things is changed, right? We draw not from our own shallow supply of love, but we draw from an infinite supply, right, of Christ's love. Let me conclude with this story. It is, how many, you guys ever read Narnia as kids? Like the Narnia series? This is C.S. Lewis, one of C.S. Lewis's book called The Voyager of the Dawn Treader, right? In this story, there's a kid named Eustace Scrub, right? Eustace Scrub, what an amazing name. This kid is pretty much, what's that? He's pretty much the most selfish kid you could think of, right? He's the type of kid that would attack little beetles, right? Who would tattle on other people just to kind of get, you know, ahead. And he is really obsessed with power, right? And so what happens is he goes into the land of Narnia, ooh, right? And then he finds this pile of treasure, right? And he's like, oh my gosh, finally my wildest dreams are come true. I'll have so much power. People have to like obey me. Like I can do whatever I want now, pretty much, right? He goes and he falls asleep on the pile of gold and treasure, and he wakes up and he is a dragon, right? Not only is he one outwardly, right? He has the scales, right? Everything. But he's actually one inwardly. He is alone, right? And callous, right? And skeptical. And his lust for this money and this treasure consumes him, right? And he's entrapped. He's enslaved by his own desire for power. Inescapable. He actually cannot associate with people. He cannot have any influence. And he is absolutely destitute, right? In the weirdest way, right? And one day, Aslan, the lion, comes to him and says, well, you're pretty miserable. And he's hurt at this point, too. You're in a lot of pain, and you're pretty filthy. You should peel off your skin and go take a bath, right? And so with a lot of doubt, he's like, I don't know if I can. I'll try. So he starts to peel off layer. He peels off one layer, and he says it feels amazing. It's like peeling off like a scab. It feels so good, right? Like, I don't know, it's painful. It's really painful, but it feels good. Like I feel like I'm like being made anew, right? And then he goes and he steps in the water and he sees his reflection and he sees a dragon in the water and goes, oh, okay, all right, I did it once before, I'll do it again, right? And he goes in the water, he goes to that the skin that he just peeled off and he peels off another layer of skin. And he's like, oh, yes, finally, oh, I feel better now. He goes to the water and same thing happens. He looks in the water and there's a dragon, right? And he does it, he goes back and he's like, okay, I mean, this might take some time, but I'll try. And he peels off a third layer and he goes, and this time he sees himself a dragon in the water, and he is completely distraught. right? And that is a picture of us and our lust for power and our pride, right? We just cannot do it on our own. But this is what C.S. Lewis writes. The lion said, but I don't know if it spoke, right? You will have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now, so I just lay flat, down on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you were ever to pick a scab off a sore. It hurts like a billy, oh, but it's such fun to see it coming out. I think he just swore there. Billy O. I don't know what that is. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done it myself the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there was I, as smooth and as soft as a peeled switch and smaller than I had been. Then he caught hold of me. I don't like that much, for I was very tender underneath, now that I had no skin. He threw me in the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. After that, it became perfectly delicious, and as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone. This is the picture of what has happened to Peter, right? He was so sure that he knew what was right. Don't touch me, Jesus, right? This is not right of you. And this is where we stand, a lot of us. In our pride, we prevent ourselves from being healed, being forgiven. We don't come to God with those things that are most painful, because you're like that callous dragon, those scales we thought were supposed to protect us, right? We don't want Jesus touching those things, right? But like a Eustace Scrub, as Jesus begins to cut away and peel away, then although it is tender, right, it leads to this love, this enduring love, right? This grace which we have isolated ourselves from. And I believe that that is the beginning in loving others, right? To enable Christ to love us, you know. When I think about where we are and even where we started at the beginning of this service, as Pastor Ben was just correcting us, it is the problem with our heart, right? We are in a place in our church chronologically where we can choose to continue doing ministry like we've been taught to, or we can take a close look and examine the things within our heart. It is like an arrow shot or a bullet shot, right? The trajectory might be off right now just an inch, right? But as that arrow travels, it will be miles, right? It will be yards and yards and yards from where God wants us to be, right? It is the heart that Christ is concerned about. It is not the superficial things. Those things are important. Yes, they are, right? It is important that you guys take membership and ministry. But if we miss out on this, then what we have is a dead religion, right? And it will only perpetuate itself unless there is humility and brokenness and obedience. Okay, thanks so much. Okay, I'll have Pastor Ben, if you could.